From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV-LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Michael Cardos, whose new novel is Bluff, published by the Mysterious Press. Michael Cardos is also the author of the novels Before He Finds Her and The Three-Day Affair, an Esquire Best Book of 2012, as well as the story collection One Last Good Time, which won the Mississippi Institute of Arts and Letters Award for Fiction, and the textbook The Art and Craft of Fiction, A Writer's Guide. His short stories have appeared in The Southern Review, Crazy Horse, Harvard Review, and many other magazines and anthologies, and have won a Pushcart Prize. Michael Cardos grew up on the Jersey Shore. He received a degree in music from Princeton University and played the drums professionally for a number of years. He has an MFA in fiction from The Ohio State University and a PhD from the University of Missouri. He lives in Starksville, Mississippi, where he is an associate professor of English and co-director of the Creative Writing Program at Mississippi State University. Here's a little information about his new novel, Bluff. At 27, magician Natalie Webb is already a has-been. A card trick prodigy, she started touring at 17, took first place at the World of Magic competition at 18, and never reached such heights again. Shunned by the magic world after a disastrous liaison with an older magician, she now lives alone in her New Jersey apartment with her pigeons and a pile of overdue bills. In a desperate ploy to make extra cash, she follows up on an offer to write a feature magazine article on the art of cheating at cards. But when she meets the perfect subject for her article, what begins as a journalistic gamble brings into question everything Natalie thinks she knows about her talent and herself. Natalie is dazzled by the poker cheat's sleight of hand and soon finds herself facing a proposition that could radically alter her fortune to help pull off a $1.5 million magic trick that, if done successfully, no one will ever even suspect happened. I hope you enjoy our conversation. So, did you like magic tricks as a kid?
As a matter of fact, I did. I was always really into it. And when I was a little kid, I liked buying little magic tricks that I could learn out of the box. And then when I was in eighth grade, my English teacher happened to be a magician. He worked at a couple local restaurants doing table hopping magic, and he started a magic club in the eighth grade. I think there were three of us in it after school, and he got me a little more into it. And then growing up on the Jersey Shore, there was a boardwalk and a little amusement park. And for a couple summers in high school, I had a job where I was doing magic shows. I had my magic booth, and I did eight 20-minute shows a day.
Wow.
Which will lock in some tricks. And so I did that. And
you do that on the boardwalk, sort of like busking?
So here's what happened. There's this boardwalk fishing pier that it was a pretty big pier, and after a while there's a haunted house on there, the kind with like the live actors and everything,
right?
And then the owners tried to turn the whole thing into a theme park. You know, you pay one admission and there's some rides and things like that. And so on the midway, I had my own little booth, so they were paying me by the hour, and I thought I was getting away with murder because I auditioned for them, and then they said, well, how much should we pay you? And I think I was 15, and minimum wage was $3.35 an hour. And I looked them in the eye and I said, I think I'm worth at least a dollar more than minimum wage. And they're like, sold. So $4.35 an hour was what I got. And it was great. It was a great job. And I did that for a couple of years. And that was sort of like my pinnacle of magic performance. And then it all was downhill from there.
Do you still play with it at all?
Well, now that I have little kids, I have an 8-year-old. So when he turned 6, I did a little party. I literally dusted off the magic set and did a show for him and his and some of his friends. But I'd always been into it. And the thing that kind of got this novel going a bit was I'd always wanted to write something about magic for reasons that we can talk about a little later. But when I started teaching undergrads, the first semester I ever taught undergraduate fiction writing, I had a student who was already a professional magician. He was touring all over the world. And he was by far and away the best close-up magician I'd ever seen. And I knew a decent amount about that kind of thing at that point. And so it was, he just like was amazing. And I think he was 19 or 20, and we stayed in touch over the years. And, you know, conversations about magic and seeing his career. And so when I sat down to actually work on this book, I knew I had my like big magic guru I could talk to that could help me out with the language and some of the milieu and things like that.
Yeah. Now, is he a writer as well?
I don't know if he wrote much fiction after being in my class.
Okay.
He was an English major though. He's written some magic books. You know, he's got some great magic books for kids and for not kids. But so he does write, and I know that he would write, you know, monthly tricks in magic magazines and stuff like that. But I don't think he's written fiction in a long time.
Oh, okay, that's great that you had him to talk to. Now I'm curious, like on your book tour, are you doing any magic as you do your readings, or is that not a thing you decided to?
I promised one and only one magic trick. So I typically did one card trick, and that was all. I think that made everybody happy. Doing exactly one and no more. And when I read in New York, I read at the Mysterious Bookshop in New York, and this magician that I was telling you about, the undergrad who's now, you know, in his 30s, Joshua Jay, he's normally traveling a lot, but he's stationary because he's doing a show in New York all summer. So he was able to come, and we did a little joint gig at the bookstore. So that was super fun.
Yeah, that's great. I think doing just one trick on your own when you're touring is probably a really good analogy for how much you should also read.
Yeah, that's right. No one has ever said, please read more at a book reading, ever.
Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about your narrator, Natalie. And I think it's really interesting that you chose to write this from the perspective of a woman. I actually think that there are lots of reasons that works really well, apart from whatever you might have found drawing you to her character. But I just wonder if you can talk about how she started for you.
She started as a indeterminate, is it going to be a male or female, man or a woman magician? And we're talking like really early when I was toying around with stuff like 10 years ago with this magician character. When I started sort of writing the book in earnest a couple of years ago, pretty quickly it made sense to have the main character be a woman, mainly because the two big milieus for this book, professional poker and professional magic, are both worlds that are like 99% male.
Right.
And so it seemed like, and not only are they by and large male, but they're by and large male and not necessarily hospitable to women who are operating at that level. So it just seemed to make it more interesting. It gave her more to deal with throughout the book.
Yeah, I wondered if that was maybe one of the reasons that you chose to make her female, but it's interesting that you chose her and then you sort of let her tell you the story of why she would be good in the role of narrator.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I don't want to give any big spoilers, but there's another, you know, important woman character too. And I think that for both of them, it wasn't only navigating in these worlds, but it was also then turning it around and see what expectations, you know, men would have for them, you know, as card players, as magicians, as poker cheats and things like that, and how they could use those expectations and sort of turn it around and use it against the other people.
Yeah. And something I hadn't really given a lot of consideration to until we just started talking about it is that Natalie's career at the beginning of the book is not going well. And I would say that part of the reason it's not going well is because she doesn't necessarily project the same image that everybody wants a woman to project. And she's quick to anger. And at a certain point, she gets into a little bit of a scuffle with one of the people that mm-hmm. she's chosen to help her in a trick. And I won't go into too much detail about that. But, you know, it's interesting that gender can really play a large role in how a character behaves, obviously. And it worked really well in this.
Thanks for saying so. It's funny, this epiphany, which probably should not have been an epiphany for me, sort of coalesced when I was, I think it's about 50 pages into the book. There's a pretty innocuous moment where Natalie's going to be driving down to Atlantic City for the first of two big poker games. There's like kind of two big poker games that sort of frame the novel. And this first one happens about 70 pages in. And she's getting into the car with this guy, this poker cheat she doesn't know very well. She's met once or twice. He's gruff. He's kind of a jerk. And all they're doing is driving from North Jersey down to Atlantic City. And when I first was sketching out that moment, I hadn't absolutely decided whether it was going to be a woman or a man.
Yeah.
And if it's a guy, it's just a guy getting into a car with another dude. Like,
right.
There's no tension. And I was like, wait a minute. But if I make her this woman magician, all of a sudden she's getting in the car with this sort of surly, sketchy guy, and they're driving through the Pine Barrens at night. Like, there's this level of threat without ever having to mention a level of threat. It's just kind of evoked. And I explained this to my wife. I was like, look at this. And she's like, right, that's what being a woman is.
Congratulations. Yeah. Welcome to my world.
Exactly. But it was, I think it was a good, you know, it was a good stand-in for kind of the rest of the novel. The threat level of everything just gets amped up.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, the guy that she gets into the car with, I, you know, again, there's so many things that we could give away by talking in too much detail, and I don't want to do that. But it's interesting how I sort of felt like this guy was like a curmudgeon who was going to turn into this sort of like fatherly, mentorly type.
Yeah.
And anyway, I won't go any further than that, but I will say that sometimes in this book, you defied my expectations, and that is a great pleasure to me as a reader, I think.
Thanks. You know, he was like such a fun character to write because, you know, yeah, that's what the sort of given narrative always is, right? The jerk, curmudgeon, mentor. And we all watch this, the sort of the mentor, you know, the Karate Kid mentor, the Rocky mentor, you know.
Yes.
These surly men who, you know, it's not that they have a heart of gold, but their surliness is there for, they believe in their surliness. You know, what's that, the drum movie, Whiplash?
Right? Oh, right.
Right.
Yeah,
and that movie defied expectations a little bit, but we all have this idea of what this male jerk mentor is like and why he does it. And I just loved him just being a jerk.
Right. Right. I mean,
just a jerk.
I think that this character in the police novel has become almost, you know, what you would expect, like, you know, I forget her, Patricia Cornwell's Marino, mm-hmm. you know, or the guy on NYPD Blue, I forget his name too, but it's like the curmudgeon who, anyway, I'm not going to go there. In this case, it was great to see him in this role that I've never ever read about before or been exposed to before, and it was really fun.
That in a way, that sort of like mentor-mentee relationship was really important to me throughout this whole novel. So that was kind of like the first one of several, you know?
Right, yeah. So another moment that I really loved was she gets this rejection letter from the World of Magic conference that she wants to participate in. And it was so much like a rejection letter from any literary journal that I've ever seen. I wondered if you stole language from an old letter.
Oh, I didn't have to steal language from a letter. I could just in my mind create them having received so many of them. Yeah, in a way, I think like everything I write is always just a big old metaphor for writing. You know, like, yeah, she got a rejection letter. Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about this. There's a line in the novel that I loved. Nothing is more honest than a magic trick.
Yeah. So one of the central things in this book that I was interested in and that Natalie as a character was interested in, why she wants to write this magazine article, is this idea of the difference between a magician and like a con artist or a poker cheat. You know, they're both using the same materials. They're both using a deck of cards. They're both using sleight of hand. They're both, you know, taking hours of practice to perfect things. But, you know, when you walk in to see a magic trick, you're expecting to be fooled. You're paying money to be fooled, and maybe you figure it out or maybe you don't, but it's like a contract and you know what to expect. So in that way, it's fair play. Whereas if you're at the card table and you know, you're not supposed to be cheated. And so, you know, same moves and everything, but it's not fair play. And I think that's what Natalie was so interested in, this idea that she felt like, what's it like to do what I do when the stakes are so much higher?
Mm-hmm. And so there's also a large part of the book that's devoted to sort of our learning the difference between a magician and a card sharp. And mm-hmm. and I think that for the uninitiated, magicians can seem like they're, you know, playing tricks on people, but that's really much, much different than a card sharp. So can you just talk a little bit about that and what drew you to that sort of like disparity?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. This goes back in a way to 2000 and gosh, probably 2004, 2003, when this magician who was my ex-student was at one point going to go on assignment, writing for a magic magazine, profiling a card cheat, and and he talked to me about it at the time,
Oh,
and it.
wow.
He never ended up writing the article, you know, and I waited a good 10 years before emailing him and saying, "Do you ever write that?" But I think that it's not an unusual thing for magicians to be interested in that kind of thing. And there's a little bit in the book about how, Di Vernon, who was like magicians regard as the best, more or less the best sleight of hand artist ever, he spent a lot of time trying to find sort of perfect what's called the center deal. And the center deal was this sort of mythical, whether it's actually doable or not, kind of sleight. And so he would travel the country trying to find card cheats who were rumored to have been able to do this kind of deal, which they found this man whose last name was Kennedy, so it became known as the Kennedy deal. So there's a sort of long history of magicians sort of being infatuated with the idea of the things that card cheats can do, card cheats or card mechanics or whatever they're called. And so that sort of history of that is something I just thought was super interesting.
Yeah, it is. And there must be a kind of grudging respect between them. And the magician who wants to have, the more honest practice m must recognize that the card sharp has to be perfect, or they're going to, at the very best, lose a lot of money, and at the very worst, possibly get in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I think that's right. And there's, I think there are people who have been, professional card con artists who have become magicians. Like Harry Anderson was one of them, right? He did the shell game in New Orleans and stuff, and then he got punched a few times and realized that maybe he should turn that into a stage act. And that's something that's happened a bunch of times. But I think that the sort of I think the magician's love of a really great card cheat is there's a lot of people who respect that because of the risk they're taking and because, like you said, their act has to be perfect.
It strikes me that this storyline, or this world in which you've created your story, we don't read a lot about card games lately. I think that in a way it's a little bit of an old time milieu that was written about or depicted a lot more in movies. A long time, not a long time, but a while ago, or maybe it cycles through. But so it was really refreshing to be in this world again, because certainly since The Sting, I haven't really spent a lot of time in this world. So does that occur to you? Are there a lot of books coming out about this sort of thing, or do you notice that yours is sort of unique right now?
I have not noticed a lot, and certainly in terms of influences, I mean, I love The Sting. It's one of my favorite movies. And there's a book that inspired The Sting called The Big Con by a writer named David Maurer. And I think he was a linguist. The book, at least nominally, is about the sort of language of cons and grifts and things like that. But that book became the basis for The Sting and also for Paper Moon, I believe. And yeah, that's older stuff. And then, when a lot of poker players talk about, I think, Rounders as like the big poker, movie that they all love, and they felt it's sort of realistic in a sense. And but yeah, in terms of really recent, there's not a whole lot. There's a magician novel called Magic, by what's the, who wrote The Princess Bride? Goldman, William Goldman, and it's really great. I didn't read it. It's funny. I didn't read it until after mine was already turned in and submitted and everything. I'd seen the movie as a kid, and it scared the daylights out of
It's
me. But
scary, yeah.
yeah, but the book is much more into the magic. The movie is much more into the ventriloquism. But
Yeah.
yeah, not so much recently.
And then also we have a lot of movies about scam artists, like the Ocean's movies. The latest one I think is Ocean's 8, and maybe they will have casino scenes, but it's not about cards, which is different.
Yeah, I think that's right. The Grifters was a great Jim Thompson's novel, but that novel came out a while ago too, and the movie came out what was that in the 90s, I guess. Yeah, I mean, part of it might be that cards are a little hard sometimes to depict in print, because it's such a visual thing.
I thought that you did that really well. It's I was actually I found, yeah. Do you mind if I read a little section of the book?
Oh my gosh, please.
Okay. So this is toward the end. I'm not going to really set the scene too much, but there are two people together. to women, and they are practicing. And so with a dramatic teenage sigh, she accepted the deck of cards and pivoted her body to the left. During this larger motion, with her body and arms, she executed the pass. It was fine. Honestly, she did the move better than most magicians I knew. And then a little later, I took the deck from her, broke it in the middle, turned over the center card, five of hearts, turned it back over, and put the deck back together, burying the card in the center. Then, under the guise of squaring up the deck, I did the move. The bottom half of the deck became the top half. If she blinked, she missed it. If she didn't blink, she missed it anyway. Okay, so I'm not going to give too much more context there, but, you know, I felt like for a lay reader who doesn't play a lot of cards and certainly doesn't try card tricks, or certainly not in any sort of professional way, God, you know, it was, I could understand that. That was enough information for me to follow, and it didn't have to get into so much detail that it felt bogged down. And I felt like you did that in the book really well.
Thank you. And that was a lot of back and forth, you know, just thinking about both how much of the card stuff to explain, but also like what sort of level of poker understanding is the reader going to have in terms of what beats what kind of hands, terminology. So yeah, thank you for saying that.
Yeah. Now, did you do a lot of research about how these tricks all work, or did you kind of already know a lot about that?
I knew a decent amount about it, but I definitely met a few times with my magician friend to suss out, am I really calling things the right things?
Yeah.
And there's a couple of deeper level moves that we worked out in the book that I did not know, or at least I had an idea of, but I didn't know what it would be called. And so all of those, there's a lot of stuff in there, a lot of terminology, you know, different table passes and certain kinds of deals. And those are all real things that we kind of worked out together.
Oh, so, I wondered, yes. Did you make anything up?
I don't think I made up any moves, no. I think there's this funny thing at the end of the acknowledgments where it's, you know, I say like all the magic in this book is real, which... you know, no animals were harmed during the making of this book, and no, I didn't make up any tricks. They're all real moves and things like that. The poker was something I knew less about, so I talked to more poker players, and it was really interesting talking to expert poker players at different levels and in different. Some poker players do casinos, and some do home games, and some play on the internet, and so. Both from this sort of technical perspective of what would someone do in a given hand, but also, again, the milieu of what's it like playing at a high stakes game, you know. So I was just interested in a lot of things, like, you know, my understanding of poker is okay, and I played a bunch of low stakes games, but I wanted to know, if you're playing at a really high stakes game, just simple things, is the TV on? Or at some point, is that
right.
Not happening? You know, just those kind of, what are you bringing to someone's house? You know, do you bring a backpack? Do you bring a purse? Do you bring, what's happening? Do you not bring anything? Are you not allowed to? So just that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I'll have to say, just like, I can't even cook dinner with the TV on. So like, if the TV was on, I would lose everything.
Yeah.
You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, 99.3 FM. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is an interview with the author Michael Cardos, whose new book is Bluff. If you're enjoying the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and help spread the word. I want to talk to you a little bit about the craft of writing, and specifically I want to talk about transitions. You had this great moment at the end of one chapter where someone picks up the cards and begins to deal, and Natalie observes everything changed forever. So that's the last line in that chapter. And then the next chapter opens, when did you first get interested in magic? I'm often asked that. And so it's just this transition. You've left us so curious about how everything changes forever. And then you take us somewhere else. And it's not a place we don't want to be, but it is, I think, a move that makes us really anxious to know more about everything, really. Can you talk a little bit about transitions?
Yeah, I mean, I think suspense is a word I love to think about and talk about, and not just with crime novels or whatever. I don't even know what my novel is. Is it a? I don't think it's a thriller. I don't know what it is, but I think suspense is really important in all novels, in all fiction, and so much of it has to do with the idea of delay. You know, you want something, and so you don't give it to the reader quite yet, but you give them something else they didn't know they wanted. So. And it doesn't really have to do with even they can even know what's going to happen. So with my students, I always like to give the idea of this inflating a balloon. If I were to just stand in front of the room and start blowing up a balloon bigger and bigger and bigger, you know it's going to explode at some point, but you can't look away because you don't know what it's going to sound like the second it's going to happen. And so even if you know the outcome, it's still suspenseful.
Right.
With something like this, I feel like, you know, I can delay the answer for a little. I bought a little bit of goodwill, like maybe is a way to explain it. You know, so everything changed forever. I know you want to know what that is. I don't want to be a tease, but I just bought a little goodwill where I can tell you something else that's really important. And you're going to pay, you're going to be hyper attuned to the thing I'm about to tell you because you're still waiting for the answer that I set up. Right.
That
so
is,
I can tell you this thing, right. I can tell you this thing about people want to know, when did I first get into magic? I want the reader to know that. It's an important bit of her backstory. So that seemed like a time to give that information, both because the reader's ready for it and also because it's that's probably somewhat on her mind at that moment.
Wow. Okay. That's great. And it's true. It's a very important chapter, but until we know more, we don't know that it's going to be very important. And it's, I thought that was really well done. Now let's see, this is another moment, where I could inadvertently give too much away, and hopeful that I don't. But there's a character that she meets, and, a woman, and she initially assumes that this is an unimportant woman, possibly a waitress in the place where they are, possibly, you know, somebody who's there to serve drinks. And and at the end of that paragraph, she says, "Shame on me." And I just read that as like a, you know, look, I'm a woman and here I am being sexist. Shame on me. Mm-hmm. Later, that takes on so much more meaning. And I loved that. And I can't explain it otherwise except just to say, that line had a lot of meaning, and we didn't know it when we read it. Although in my own case, I remembered it because I remembered it having some meaning in a different sense in that moment. Do you remember writing that line, or was that just something that happened, one of those wonderful serendipitous lines that turns out to be great?
I think it was one of those happy accidents, you know, and it's, I think it's not coincidental that happy accidents tend to happen when I'm the most immersed in the moment of writing it. You know, if I'm thinking too hard about crafting it, it doesn't really happen. But I feel like, I sort of vaguely remember writing it, but not trying to think about it, if that makes any sense.
Yes. Yeah. And to me, that was one moment of many that I would call a little bit of your fictive sleight of hand in a book about sleight of hand. And I'm sure that even though it was one of those happy coincidences, I think on the larger scale in this book, you were trying to make that happen. So I was curious if in trying to make that happen, and I thought you managed it really well, did you ever, maybe upon your revision, decide, okay, I'm being a little heavy-handed here, or I need to change this to make it more subtle or more finesse? You know, did you feel that way at all?
Okay, so to back up a little bit,
sure.
So this is my third novel, and the first novel, The Three-Day Affair, I did not write to be any particular kind of, again, like thriller or crime novel or something, but it ended up, you know, the Mysterious Press ended up wanting it, and so it got printed, you know, got published as a crime novel. And what was really interesting to me were sometimes I would have, a comment or an email saying, "Oh, I really love the novel. I figured out the ending at page blah, blah, blah." And my reaction to that was always like, "Awesome. That's so great. You were so involved in the book." I didn't realize that was a complaint, because I think, oh my gosh, if somebody's super into the novel and they're thinking about it and trying to figure it out, like, that's so cool. So, and then with my second novel, which is, you know, again, the same press and published as a crime novel, I would get the same kind of emails every once in a while. And my reaction was always like, awesome, that's so great. You know, we're in this together. And so with this one, with Bluff, I think part of it is because the novel is about, you know, bluffing and conning and deceit and covering up and magic, I felt like two things. I felt like I had a little bit more leeway to sort of try to embody the form of magic in the content, right? So I was able to sort of be a little more conscious about sort of, I don't want to say playing with the reader because that sounds manipulative, but, you know, doing what a magician might do with his or her audience, okay?
Yes.
At the same time, I was like, I don't want that email this time. And I haven't gotten any. I haven't gotten a single email this time. So I think it was a little more, it was the first time I was a little more conscious. It sounds kind of silly because in a way it's the third crime novel, but it's the first time I've been a little conscious of a reader out there who might be reading to figure it out as opposed to someone who's just reading along for the ride, which is honestly how I read. Even if I'm reading a mystery, I'm not trying to solve the mystery. I'm like the easiest mystery reader in the world because I just go along for the ride.
Right. And that's because you're a writer and you're appreciating what you're reading on the page instead of trying to just figure out the plot. let's talk about that. You have written a book on craft, The Art and Craft of Fiction. And so I wondered what it was like writing a book on craft.
It was really fun. I don't think I'd want to do it right now, but it was really fun when I did it, which is back in like 2010, 2011. What happened was I graduated from college as a music major. I'm a drummer, and that's what I did for 8 years.
Oh, yeah.
And so I didn't go back to grad school till I was 30. And I didn't know any other writers until that point. So my introduction to learning how to write fiction was really reading a lot and also becoming a craft book junkie. Like, I just loved craft books. I would take them all out and read them and triangulate advice and everything. And so kind of from the moment I got involved in writing a lot of fiction, I was always thinking about, okay, if I were to write one of these craft books, what would be in it? And so it just was one of those, you know, kind of moments, sort of lucky moments, where I was having lunch at a conference with an editor from Bedford St. Martin's with the idea of maybe I'd review some of their new books or something. But then at the end of lunch, the editor said, you know, we actually don't have a fiction writing craft book. Had you ever think of doing one? And I was like, yeah, I thought about doing one for the past 10 years. And so I sort of scribbled out chapter titles on a napkin. And she said, well, I can't submit a napkin. You'll have to write a proposal. But pretty quickly, it kind of all came together. And it was really fun to work on because I had been teaching just long enough where I had a decent amount of experience teaching, but these ideas of how I would teach were really fresh on my mind. So I wrote it pretty quickly. I don't really remember writing it very much because I had a newborn at the time. So let's keep it passive voice. It got written. And so it was really fun to work on. And, you know, it's useful because I think what it let me do was I might have taught a certain concept 7 different ways. And it made me think about, yeah, but what's the best way? What's the right language and everything? So it sort of coalesced my own thinking about a lot of these things.
Do you feel that in the end, writing that book gave you some insight into what might be done differently in writing a book on craft and teaching craft, you know, standing in front of students?
It did. And it was funny, after I wrote the book, I was going to teach from it because those, you know, it was all the things that I would be teaching anyway, but I had to figure out how to do it a little bit because I was like, well, whatever I say right now is not going to be as nicely, concisely put as the thing that you just read for today. So I had to figure that out a little bit. But yeah, it was helpful as a teaching tool, and that's really how it got put together. It's not that I was itching to write a craft book so much as it came along at the moment where I was thinking pretty heavily about those kinds of things anyway.
Yeah. Now, had you already published novels at that point?
No, I had my first book is a story collection, and that came out right around the same time. But I did not have any novels out yet.
And was that with St. Martin's?
No, the story collection was with a press called Press 53 out of Winston-Salem.
Oh yeah, I know Press 53. Yeah. No, I'm just curious why you were having lunch with that editor. Was that somebody you'd worked with, or how did that come about?
Let's see, somebody who I went to grad school with used to be an editorial assistant there, and just knew that this particular editor was just looking to meet some people who might review some of their recent titles.
Interesting.
So, yeah, it was a totally random thing, and we just hit it off. I mean, she was just this sort of ideal editor where we became friends and just got along really well.
And did she become your editor on the craft book?
She did. She became the editor on the craft book right on through the first edition, and then she left the company, but she was like, you know, a perfect editor to work with for a couple of years.
And then did you get an agent in order to sell that project, or did you not have an agent?
I did. You know, I think a lot of textbooks are not done with an agent, but because I was sort of, my brain was generally in trade fiction. I did have an agent just kind of go through the contract and stuff. It wasn't super complicated in that, because the book was already sold.
Sure.
But just for language and the contract and things.
Now, I'm just curious, with that situation, and you've gotten an agent to look at something that you've already sold, would that person then naturally become your agent for your fiction, or did that...
Actually, what's funny is it was the other way around, because I had an agent. I think at that point I had an agent for my fiction.
Oh, okay.
But that agent didn't want to do the textbook because they were kind of already representing someone who did a competing book. But I knew someone else who I thought would do it, and she did. So okay. It was sort of easy, yeah.
Now, so, and what year did that book come out?
I think it was, the first edition was 2011, I believe.
All right. So you have like,
yeah.
You have like an 8-year-old now?
I do. I have an 8-year-old and a 4-year-old.
Yeah. So I love the line about youth sports leagues. You can't even imagine what these people are like. I read that line. I have boys. They're all grown up now, but I read that line and I'm like, this is somebody who's been at youth sports games.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We're in the middle of soccer and things. And I got roped into coaching the first year, and I don't know anything about soccer. And I can say, honestly, it was the worst decision I ever made in my life.
Yeah.
Like, I've made some bad decisions, but being suckered into coaching soccer for a season was, I mean, it was such a bad, and everyone was nice. The parents were nice. The kids were nice. I was a terrible coach.
Oh no.
I was hard. I don't know how to play soccer. You know, they were like, don't worry. You're just going to be an assistant. You'll have a main coach. And then a week later, I was like, congratulations, you're the main coach. There's no assistant. So, and I was like, you know what? The one thing I have to get out of this is a good essay. And I didn't even get that. I didn't even get a good essay about coaching youth soccer and being terrible at it. Though I did just finish a draft of a middle grade novel called The U11 Soccer Chronicles.
Oh, there you go. So you got to use it after all.
Yeah.
Let's see. Let's talk a little bit about the book design. And that doesn't mean I've run out of substantive questions about the text, but I loved the book design. I thought it was wonderful. On the cover, the title is spelled out in what turn out to be playing cards. But I have to be honest, when I first glanced at it, I thought it was sort of streaked with blood. Was that purposeful, or is that the first time you've heard that?
Maybe yours was streaked with blood.
No.
No, I haven't heard that before, but I love that idea.
Well, the cards are at an angle, and unfortunately this is radio, so I can't really show, but well, actually it'll be on the podcast site, but the cards are at an angle, and just the way that the angle shadows the suits that are there, the diamonds and hearts, to me are, and they're elongated, and it just looked like a little, to me at first glance, I'm like, oh, blood dripping down. And then I realized, no, those are playing cards. Pay attention.
Oh, that's pretty neat. No, I hadn't. It's funny. I really love the cover. And I figured three novel, I had made no suggestions for covers up until this point. I liked the covers, but I was like, all right, third novel, I've got some ideas. I'm going to make some suggestions. And thank goodness they ignored all of them, because this is better than what I had come up with.
Okay, that's great. And then another thing about the book design that I thought was very appropriate and unique was the sections have, the chapters are numbered by card numbers. So it starts with ace instead of one, and it goes up from there. And that was really fun too.
Yeah, that was whoever had done the interior just came up with that idea, and it was great. I love it.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see. You know, that bit that I read before about how their dealing cards, and I was just talking about describing card tricks and how well I thought you did that. But then I forgot to read that in the next paragraph, Natalie observes, you know, that the world spun on around me. She's talking about when she was young and learning tricks, and how, you know, she'd stay in her room and practice and practice and practice while the world spun on around her. And the interesting thing to me is that the spin pass is a card term. And so the world spun on around me made a certain sense with this term that we keep hearing, the spin pass. I just loved that. I don't know if that was another happy coincidence, but I like it when I notice relevant wordplay in a book. And I wondered if you have anything to say about that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I love that too. And this idea of like things kind of echoing other things. And yeah, I always love that. And there's certain words, you know, just the word hands comes up, and I thought in really interesting ways, and in ways that I tried to, again, not make too overt, but the use of hands that mean so many different things in the novel.
Right.
What was really, one word that was really hard, which I ended up, you know, a book about cards, there is not one use of the word Trump in the
book. Yeah, I play a little bridge, and we've had conversations about perhaps trying to come up with a new word.
it kind of ruins a game of bridge. And it's funny because words, you know, take on, like, that word is so loaded now that for a book about cards, I just had to, even just not just in terms of card play, but it's a word I used a lot in my past. You know, it's a great word. And I had to find, exceeded. It's such a bad alternative. But so I had to go through the novel and excise all those, you know, that I'd written. But
yeah. Well, I think that was just a service to the larger community. let's talk a little bit about, I'm going to say minor characters, although I think they have large roles to play. But you have a couple of characters in this book. Harley is mm-hmm. Natalie's upstairs neighbor. And Calvin is a boy who lives nearby who's in his, I would say, I'm trying to remember it, but I think early teens, kind of middle age, middle school age, learning how to be cool and definitely pulling it off some of the time. When you're writing, are you thinking about the world that you should fill in around people, or did these characters have specific purposes to you as you introduced them, or did that kind of come to you as you went?
I think it's both. I generally prefer to write a small cast of characters and give everybody a role. You know, like I when I open up a novel and I see like a family tree, I want to have a heart attack. So and so I'm not that, as a person, I'm not that good with names and remembering names. So I just try to keep the population small and give everybody names that are really different from one another. And I think everybody should have a motive role in the story. So, you know, Natalie lives in the lower apartment. Someone's got to live upstairs. And so I wanted, and it quickly became clear that she would be this animal person, and that would have a role in the story. And then cool Calvin across the way. Yeah, I mean, both of those characters get introduced fairly early. So I think I had a sense of what they were like fairly early. I didn't necessarily know exactly how they'd come into play.
So to speak. I enjoy both of them, and I you know, when a new character walks on stage, so to speak, you kind of always wonder what's going to happen with them. And I really was very fond of them, and I'm not always very fond of what I would call secondary characters, and yet I thought these were great. Let's see. So I want to talk a little bit about foreshadowing without foreshadowing anything for listeners. But during an evening in which Natalie and a friend are practicing for another important evening, they are having a conversation. They're having fun. They're still sort of getting to know each other. They're having fun. They're talking about their past. And then something happens, and the conversation turns from upbeat to depressing very mm-hmm. quickly. And Natalie thinks, amazing how quickly an evening can turn dark. And that jumped out at me as I read it. I won't say that I'm one of those readers who at any point felt like I had figured out what was going to happen in this book, but that line jumped out at me. And I wanted to know, when you put that in, did you put that in on the first draft, or did you put that in later?
Yeah, that was a first draft line.
Yeah.
It really, at the time of writing, it wasn't intentionally foreshadowing. It was just, I knew what was happening in that scene, that, you know, they would have this disagreement. And so, I think Natalie as a character is somebody who is so badly looking for camaraderie.
Yes.
And friendship that I think it would strike her that, oh my gosh, why did I just do that? We have this really nice light evening going and I screwed it up with this, like, what am I doing? I think, so it was more of her reaction in the moment. But yeah, obviously it sort of functions too as foreshadowing, but that wasn't what I intended off the bat.
Right. Okay. All right. Now I was going to ask you, what you've read lately that you might recommend to listeners.
Sure. I'm reading a novel right now, and I'm not quite done with it, but I've read enough of it that I definitely recommend it. It's a novel by Peter Golden. I think it's his third novel, and it's called Nothing is Forgotten.
Okay.
And I just happened to walk into a bookstore when he was signing books and we were chatting, and his novel sounded really cool, and it's fantastic. It's kind of like this Philip Roth meets like City of Thieves, David Benioff.
It's
like,
wow.
it's just this great mashup of things, and part of it takes place in New Jersey in the 50s, and then it jumps over to Russia, you know, and the spy stuff, and there's like a mystery in there. It's just this big, immersive, really, really good book.
Is it contemporary, like the setting?
No, it takes place mostly in the late 50s.
Oh, okay. All
yeah.
Right.
But it just came out. I think it just came out a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, that sounds great. I haven't heard of that. Well, thanks. And then I wanted to ask what you're working on. Do you know what you're going to write next? You just said that you have a middle grade novel coming out.
Well, it's not coming out yet. I'm still drafting it, but it's, you know, I have a draft almost together. You know, as my kids get older and can read and stuff, I kind of, I don't know, I've been reading so many books for that age that it seemed fun to try to do one. And I got to get something out of this soccer coaching business, you know? So something good must come of it. So I'm working on this book about a soccer team, but it's short, you know, it's probably the equivalent of 80 pages. So, but the next grown-up thing I'm working on, I'm pretty sure is going to be about, I guess the easiest way to say it is the world's largest art museum heist.
Ooh.
And I think which is funny because in a way I think it's going to be less of a mystery than some of the other ones, but that's the basic milieu of it.
Okay. Is it going to be about a real heist or are you making up a heist?
It's a real heist in my mind.
Okay. As far as writing something relevant for your kids, I will just say I hope that it is as much of a success as Justin Cronin's The Passage, which I believe he started because his kids said, write a zombie book.
That's so funny. Well, what happened was a couple of years ago, you know, when my 8-year-old was six or so, you know, he didn't play by himself a lot. And I was like, oh my gosh, please play by yourself for 15 minutes. I'll write you a chapter, because he was into books, right?
Ah.
And so I wrote him this book 15 minute chunks at a time, and it was really fun. And so now that he's older and reading more, you know, larger and more interesting things, I wanted to try it again. So that was the idea there.
Oh, and does he play by himself better now?
Yeah, actually he does.
Well, that had a good, okay, let's see. I have a couple of questions about advice. We already talked a little bit about suspense, but I did find that the suspense in this book was unique. You know, I mean, it's like you said, you're not sure what it is. It's a mystery, but it's also a book about magic. It's a book about trickery. And we know that from the start. And yet there's a lot we don't know, and there are a lot of surprises, and it was just such a pleasure, I will say that again, as a reader, to be surprised.
Thank you.
So I wonder if you can, just for listeners who are writers, can you give a little advice for writing suspense?
For writing suspense? Yeah, okay, sure. I mean, I think one thing is to, can I go back to that balloon example? I think
you may.
Maybe one way of thinking about that balloon example is, I'm blowing up the balloon and you know it's going to explode, but you don't know when, blah, blah, blah. But what happens if when it actually explodes, something unexpected happens and it's not just a pop, you know, it's something else appears there or something. So, you know, in terms of writing advice, what happens if you write a little scene, but you give away the ending of the scene in the first line?
Yeah.
So right away, the reader's not reading for the outcome. Right, they're reading for something a little deeper. So you give away the outcome, and then you still write the scene. And then maybe at the end, it's not that you lie. I mean, you give them that outcome, but you give them something else or something bigger or something broader or more context or something that makes them realize that was more than just the outcome that they were promised at the beginning.
Yes.
That's super vague advice. I can give a more specific.
Well, no, it reminds me, just I'll say this while it's still relevant, it reminds me of Donna Tartt's The Secret History, which starts out, I don't remember the sentence, but it's something like Bunny was already dead when the police, you know, and covered by snow when the police came to campus, something like that. So we know about that aspect of the book. And I think that's a lot like what you're saying. That book is so much more interesting than just, you know, who's going to die.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, a more sort of practical, perhaps writing, you know, prompt or something like that. One thing that I always like assigning is, you know, everybody has a hobby that they're really good at, that they're kind of expert at, you know, whether it's magic or something else.
Right.
And I love the idea of writing a scene in which a character is doing that because the writer has the expertise to describe it, but that's not the point of the scene. So, because like so often, you know, this, you give them something to do, you have a couple, you have to write a breakup scene. And so often the go-to is to write it in a coffee shop, right, to write it in the kitchen, to write it. But, you know, but I had a student once who happened to be working in a vet's office putting, and they specialized in putting dogs to sleep.
Oh, wow.
Like that was their thing. And so I was like, wow, what a great setting for a breakup, you know? So you got to put this dog to sleep, and then in comes the boyfriend being like, this has got to end, you know, and you got to carry on this conversation while doing this, this other totally different thing. And to me, that just makes it so much more interesting and introduces possibility for complication or plot, or what if the, you know, the person whose dog is being put to sleep rushes in at the last minute and says, I can't do it. Or, you know, there's, so you have these sort of simultaneous storylines going on at the same time. But meanwhile, the writer then has the technical know-how to describe the instruments and what it feels like and how the dog's positioned and all that. So that sort of authority on that task will bleed over to authority in the whole scene.
Yeah. It's funny when you mention that about the coffee shop. I mean, I think that in our writing, we try so hard to avoid cliche, and yet sometimes we go there just because we don't know what else to do. Another example that comes to my mind is gestures. You know, I think right now I'm working on a book, and I'm literally doing a search and replace of all of my characters shaking their heads and nodding. And
oh, I do that too. I swear, for this book and for, I always do a search for nodding, shaking head, because you need, you know, you have a little tiny pause in the dialogue, right? And you need a little filler, and so they nod, they shrug, you know. And it can seem like your characters all have Tourette's or something.
Exactly,
you know?
So
funny. I do the same thing.
And actually, I think a lot of the time when I put in those gestures, I'm giving myself a moment as the writer, but I don't necessarily need a moment in the scene. And some of the times when I'm going through and doing that search and replace, I'm just taking them out because we don't actually need anything right there. You know, because in the you know, two sentences back, she, you know, realized her laces were undone and retied her shoe. I don't know, whatever. But, you know, sometimes we don't need quite as much as we try to put in.
I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah. All right. So speaking of search and replace, this is my last question for you. But I am always fascinated to find out how writers approach revision. You know, are you a person who revises as you go, and so at the end of your draft, you have very little left to do? Or do you fly through and get it on the page and then go through 17 more times? Or how do you approach that?
Okay. So I am definitely not get it on the page fast kind of person. I feel like I've got to go slow enough that the voice is kind of right, and the prose is kind of right, because otherwise I don't have anything. You know, like I feel like you know what I mean. Like I don't even know what the character is going to be thinking about if the voice isn't right. So I go slow enough that I feel like I just want the pages to read like pages. I don't plot out every detail, but I have a basic structure. Where is it going to start? Where is it going to end? I think, and what are the two or three or four big things to happen along the way? And then I write kind of slow. So when I'm done with a draft, it kind of reads like a draft, but I go back a lot. You know, I do change a lot, but, I don't whip through. Like, I feel like if I'm going to sit down and work on a novel, stories are a little different, but for a novel where I have a lot of pages to write, if I can write 500 to 750 words in a big chunk of, in 3 hours or something like that, in a 3 or 4 hour chunk, which was what, a page and a half, I'm really happy.
Wow.
You know?
I can
go fast, and sometimes I'll go faster if something's really flying, but, I just need to go. And what I've learned now 3 times out is that the first 50 pages are hard. The second 50 pages are killer.
Yeah.
I feel like the second 50 pages is like, it takes me about 100 pages to make it to the point where I feel like I really understand the voice of what I'm doing. And then from then on, it actually, so far, maybe it'll be different this time, got a little bit easier. But those I go really slow and revise kind of a lot in those first 100 pages, and then can pick up pace a little bit.
Okay. And then when you do finish a draft, what's your next step?
Then when I get it as good as I can get it, then my wife reads it, because she's a writer. She's mainly a poet, but she teaches also at Mississippi State. She's a professor there. So she's like, she has the emotional intelligence I lack. So she'll read it. And then I've got a couple of friends who typically will read it. And then after I put together all their notes and revise it some more, then I'll give it to my agent.
Okay. Great. Okay. And then are you likely to get a lot of notes from your agent?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So she'll give me some notes, just kind of as thorough as any of my readers before her. It's just that I want her to get the better version. I want her to get the best version.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah. Okay.
but yeah, then we'll work it. Usually considerable amount. Some line level stuff, but mainly just bigger idea, kind of like, is it starting? How are the first chapter or two working? Are there things, questions she has along the way?
Yeah. All right. And are you ever resistant to people's suggestions? Do you have a hard time with that?
No, I mean, after I have an MFA, which was 3 years of workshop, and a PhD, which is a couple more years of work. After that many workshops, no, I like it. I'm really greedy for any advice. It's not that I accept all of it, but I'm usually pretty greedy for advice.
All right. Well, wonderful. Michael Kardos, I want to just thank you very much for being on the show. The name of the novel is Bluff, published by the Mysterious Press, which is an imprint of Grove Atlantic. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much. It was really fun.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the author Michael Kardos. We discussed his new novel, Bluff, published by the Mysterious Press, which is an imprint of Grove Atlantic. You can learn more about his work at michaelkardos.com, and that's spelled with a K, not a C like in cards. This week's Write the Book prompt comes from my interview with Michael Kardos. You heard us discussing suspense, and I asked him for some advice for writing unique suspense. And that led to a conversation in which he suggested a writing prompt, and that is the one for this week. Take a hobby, something that you do, something that you know a lot about, and write a scene in which a character is doing that thing, your hobby, but it is not the point of the scene. It makes for more interesting possibilities in plot and execution. Your authority in that task, whatever tools or implements that you need in order to do it well, what kind of technical information you need to understand, will come through and lend authority to the entire scene. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. Today's show is just an hour long, so I'm going to close it out now. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that Write the Book is on iTunes, and you can also find it at writethebook.podbean.com, and those podcasts are free. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest, an author whose work you really love, that you know they have a new book coming out, or comments about the show, or news about book-related events that are happening in the state of Vermont, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you're an author and you have an event happening at a local bookstore anywhere in the state of Vermont or in a town hall or wherever, let me know, and I'll include it in the Bookworm's calendar. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. So, as I said, we've run a short show this week, just 1 hour. Stay tuned now for music, and then Democracy Now! Will be coming up at 5 o'clock. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 993wbtv.org. Have a great week.
Let her be. She's the little queen of space, and the men will not let her be. Every time she makes a spread, fair brown coat, she just runs all over me. I'm gonna get me a gallant woman. That's the last thing. thing that I do. You're gonna get me a gambling woman. If it's the last thing that I do. Well, a man don't need a woman. Who's Fair Brown that he got to give all his money to.